What is up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. I'm recording this on Thursday, December 19th, and we just had the NBA Cup come to a conclusion earlier this week with the Milwaukee Bucks easily defeating the Oklahoma City Thunder in the final in what was a little bit of an ugly game, but entertaining nonetheless. We had the semifinals and quarterfinals of the Cup over the weekend before. So I'm going to talk all things NBA Cup, both from the lens of this year and how it played out, as well as more big picture in terms of moving forward. Should they make any tweaks or anything like that? Then going to get into some trade rumors. We did have a semi-consequential trade over the weekend with Dennis Schroeder going to the Warriors. And then there's been a lot of buzz around Jimmy Butler potentially being a trade target, as well as some teams that are interested in him. So going to talk through the trade that went down, as well as the Jimmy Butler rumors and all of the teams that are potentially being linked to him. So with that being said, let's go ahead and get right into it. So starting off with the Cup final from Tuesday night earlier this week, in which the Bucks pretty resoundingly knocked off the Thunder 97-81. This was close for most of the first half before Milwaukee started to run away with it in the third quarter. They were up by as many as around 20 points in the fourth quarter. And not only did they hold OKC to only 81 points overall, but they held them to 31 points total in the second half. They could not get anything going offensively. Shea had one of his worst games of the season, only 21 points on 8 of 24 from the field, 2 of 9 from 3. Jalen Williams was not his normal efficient self, only 8 of 20 from the field with 18 points. And then outside of Hartenstein, who pitched in 16, most of those coming in the first half, nobody else on the team had more than 5 points outside of Isaiah Joe, who only had 7 himself and was 1 for 6 from 3. And so it would be pretty easy just to write this off as a game in which, look, OKC just couldn't make any outside shots. I mean, they were 5 for 32 overall. That's 15.6% from deep. They were only 29 of 86 from the field overall. That's 33.7% from the field. Those are most likely Oklahoma City's worst shooting games that they're going to have all season long. And look, maybe if OKC makes a couple more threes, this is a little bit closer in the second half, and they have at least a chance to win it. But I'm not going to take anything away from Milwaukee here because they looked spectacular, particularly defensively. They didn't shoot crazy efficient for this game either, only 42% from the field, but they were much better from deep, 17 of 40. That's 42.5%. But Giannis did what he has been doing for weeks now, 26, 19, 10, 3 blocks, 2 steals, shooting better than 50% like he has in every single game this entire season. And he is firmly putting himself in the MVP conversation right alongside Jokic after what was a terrible start for Milwaukee this season. They started 2-8. This is a team that I picked to make the finals preseason. So when they started 2-8, obviously was not looking good on that front, but they have turned it around in a big, big way since then. They have gone 13-3 in their last 16 games, if you include the Cup game, which I know technically does not count for the record, but just for the purpose of this, 13-3 in their last 16. That is tied for the best record in the NBA since November 11th with the Thunder and the Celtics, the two other teams alongside the Cavs that have been viewed as the favorites so far this season in their respective conferences. They, in that span, are 8th in defensive rating, an area that they've been highly, highly criticized. And for largely good reasons this season, they have not looked good on that end of the court. But they have 110 defensive rating over that span. As I said, 8th in the league. They are 10th in offensive rating in that span at 116. And so they've been very solid for over a month now. One of the best teams in the NBA, net rating of +6 in that span. That's 8th in the league. So they really have turned it around. And I know they've had a little bit of an easier schedule over that span. I mean, included in those wins is Raptors, the Pistons twice, the Bulls, the Hornets, the Wizards, the Nets, the Magic without two of their best players. And they've had some close games in there too. But that is just what happens in the Eastern Conference. We've talked about it all year in terms of just how poor this conference has been comparatively to the West and how there's really a couple of good teams at the top and not much else to write home about. But look, they're taking care of business. That's what they're supposed to do. After the 2-8 start, this is about as good of a turnaround as you could have hoped for. They're taking advantage of the lighter schedule that they've had. But it's not just the results. It is the eye test with this team and some of the adjustments that they've made on Doc Rivers' front in terms of what's been able to turn them around. I mean, just the lineup changes to increase AJ Green's minutes, who is shooting a ridiculous 48% from three-point range this season. Been a surprisingly effective perimeter defender to this point. Obviously doesn't look like he'd be much of a threat out there, but he's been pretty solid. I mean, on both ends, and he's knocking shots down. They needed guys like him that can go out there and be legitimate threats when Giannis is getting double teamed or Dame is getting blitzed on the perimeter and the ball swings around and finds a guy open in the corner. AJ Green has been that guy that's been able to knock down shots from outside. And then also the addition of Andre Jackson Jr. into the starting lineup in place of Gary Trent Jr. has been huge for them. We've talked about how Doc Rivers doesn't normally like playing young guys, doesn't love putting rookies out there, prefers to lean on the veteran guys where he knows what he's going to get every night. But look, Andre Jackson has been massive for this team because of what he brings defensively. He's not a great three-point shooter, though he has still shot 38% from outside on the year on lower volume. But, you know, he's at least willing to take that shot, and he's made it at a somewhat respectable clip to this point. But what he brings as a point of attack defender is exactly what this team has desperately, desperately needed really throughout each of the past two seasons. Ever since they traded Jrue Holiday, they've really lacked that. And he has brought that aspect to this rotation and to the starting lineup. And look, he was the primary defender on Shea for most of this game. And like I said, Shea probably had his worst game of the whole season. He's not going to shoot 8 for 24 very often. This is a dude who's like above 50% from the field every single season and a 30-plus point per game scorer while doing so. So he's been super impressive. The combination of him and AJ Green getting more minutes has been a huge adjustment for Doc Rivers, getting out of his comfort zone a little bit, playing the younger guys, leaning more away from Gary Trent. DeLon Wright has not even really been in the rotation for some of these games. Pat Connaughton's minutes are down. Both those dudes have not really shot super well from outside this season. And of course, it helps that Chris Middleton has started to come back. He has not shot the ball well at all so far, only 26% on the season. He's only played in four games. He's on a major minutes restriction, did not play in the cup final. But it's Middleton with him back. It's not even so much that, oh, they're getting a 22 to 24 per game score back in Chris Middleton, because he's probably not in that anymore. But they don't need him to be that. They really just need somebody else who can handle the ball a little bit, get some shot creation for himself, and he's an underrated playmaker for others. He can run the pick and roll with Giannis to an extent, as well as Dame. And he's a guy that teams are going to respect out on the three-point line. When they're swinging the ball, they're not going to leave him open. And look, I know he's had double knee surgery, so who knows what he's going to look like once he ramps back up. I don't think he's going to continue to shoot 26% from the field. But the point is, having him back is instrumental to this team making any sort of run come playoff time. Again, they don't need him to be the 30 to 35 minute per game guy, the 20 to 25 point per game guy that he's been in the past. They just need somebody who can give them some reliable shooting, a little bit of shot creation, some size and length defensively, even though he has lost a step there. But him being back is huge for them because it also moves everyone else down in the pecking order. You're not relying as heavily on Taurean Prince, who, by the way, is leading the NBA in three-point shooting at 52%. But that's not going to be sustainable. It's not going to. And I don't know if you're going to trust him to hit those shots come playoff time. But now Prince is more of a luxury, a guy that if he hits shots, great. If he doesn't, that's okay because we've got other options. Same thing for a guy like Gary Trent. And same thing for a guy like even Bobby Portis, who was terrible to start the season, but has played a lot better in recent weeks since they've been playing a little better in this recent stretch. But Middleton's been huge for them. But ultimately, to me, all of that stuff is relevant and a huge factor as to why they've turned it around. But to me, the biggest thing that for why they've been so good recently, it starts with the two stars at the top. I think the synergy between Dame and Giannis has finally started to look less clunky. It is weird because when Dame got traded to Milwaukee, it felt like it was going to be seamless. Like, Dame has never played with a big with that kind of talent who can finish around the hoop, who's that much of an athlete, who can just score at will, dominate physically. And Giannis had never really played with a guard who can do the things Dame can do, shooting from outside with shot creation, get to the rim, just such a threat offensively. And so it seemed like a match made in heaven on paper because their games kind of complemented each other super well. But it's been not as maybe as well of a pairing as you would have thought, at least. But I think recently they've started to build that chemistry up a little bit better. Less your turn, my turn. Less forcing the pick and roll when Giannis doesn't really love to be a screener very often anyway. But they've been able to coexist and they have both been playing spectacular basketball. Damian Lillard certainly did have a down shooting season last year. I mean, he was down to only 42% from the field. That was his lowest since 2016 for a healthy season out of him. And this year he's back up to 45%, which is comfortably above his career shooting percentage. His three-point shooting is up from last season. His scoring volume is up from last season. His assist totals are up from last season. And eye test wise, he's just been a little bit more consistent and a little bit more reliable. He's having less of those stinker games that he had pretty frequently at times last year. But the Dame is washed narrative, I never really bought into that. I mean, even last year for a disappointing Dame season, he averaged 24 points, 7 assists, made an all-star team. Like, he was still very good. And this season, he's been even better. Right about 26 points per game, 7.5 assists. Like, he's been as advertised as the second fiddle on this team. But the reason that they are where they are and the turnaround they've had is because of how just incredible Giannis has been so far this season. As I mentioned earlier, he has not had a single game this season shooting below 50% from the field. And just some of the games he's had this season: 59 points on 21 of 34, 43 points on 18 for 29, 42 points on 15 for 24, 41 on 17 for 24, 38 on 15 of 23, 37 on 17 for 22. I mean, he's had some ridiculous shooting nights. He had a 10 for 11 game. He had a 9 for 12. Like, he's had I think 4 or 5 different games where he shot 70% or better from the field. And he is currently right now averaging 33 points per game on 61% from the field, which is legitimately historically unprecedented for a player to do. Among all players ever to average 30 plus points per game, he has the highest field goal percentage in NBA history, and second is his season last year. So he's the only player ever to average 30 plus points on 60 plus percent shooting. The next highest field goal percentage was 58% by Adrian Dantley back in 1983. But Giannis has been essentially the most efficient scorer from the field for a 30 point per game guy ever. And then if you look at the guys who have shot 60% or better from the field ever, he is comfortably, I mean, he's, I think, 5 to 6 points higher than the next player to ever shoot 60% or better. It was actually Zion Williamson did it back in 2021 with 27 points per game. But I mean, it's just crazy how dominant this guy has been, because he's been spectacular defensively as well. He's been better there than he was last year, in my opinion. He's been a great distributor. I mean, he's averaging over 6 assists. He's an elite rebounder. He is just doing it all. And we know how dominant he can be in the paint, but he has been a significantly improved mid-range shooter this season. And he's also completely cut out the three-point shot. He's attempting only 0.7 three-pointers per game on the season. That is the second lowest of his career, lowest since he was a 20-year-old second-year player. And on the season, he only has 17 attempts from outside. And then in the mid-range, he's shooting 46% on long mid-range shots. He's only been above 40 on that number twice in the past, and he's 44% on mid-range overall, which is 61st percentile for his position. And obviously, he's not been a good shooter from mid-range for most of his career, and he's only shot above 40%, even 40% from mid-range overall one time in his career. He's normally in the low to mid-30s there, so 44% is a huge jump for him. The best mid-range shooters in the league shoot, I mean, like a little bit below 50%. So he's not so far off. So the fact that he's basically cutting out three-pointers from his game, he's significantly improved in the mid-range, and he continues to just be the most dominant player in the paint in the entire league. He is just deadly in transition. He can handle the ball. He makes the right extra passes, but there's no player that can really guard him individually straight up. I mean, OKC has been one of the most, like, to put it quite frank, one of the best defensive teams we've seen in a really long time, like not just this season. They've been dominant on that end, but they had no answer for him. They couldn't guard him. They don't have a guy that they can stick out. And they tried to do the build the wall at times, but even that, like, maybe that can work in a playoff series over time, but like in the regular season, that has not proven to be a successful strategy against Milwaukee, because the dude is efficient as hell and he's scoring at volumes that really nobody else in the league is either. So Giannis is just so special, and that's why I've been so high on the Bucks this year. I thought he was going to come out with a revenge type season, and that's exactly what he's done. Even when they were 2-8, I still believed that they would at the very least avoid the play-in, still make the playoffs, and have a chance in the playoffs to really beat anybody except maybe Boston. But all of that is really just because Giannis, my belief in him. Like, they're going to have the best player in the series every single series they play until they get to the NBA Finals, and then maybe they played like the Nuggets or something, or the Mavs. You could argue they don't. But for it's in all likelihood, they're going to have the best player in every single series they play in the postseason this year, which is why I picked Milwaukee in the finals, which is why I still think they have a chance. And I know Cleveland's been awesome this year. I know the Knicks are starting to turn things around a little bit for them this season. But to me, Milwaukee has as good of a chance as anybody outside of Boston to make the finals. I think that they could completely, I wouldn't shock me at all if they knocked off Cleveland. It wouldn't shock me at all if they knocked off the Knicks. I mean, there's no scenario with Milwaukee that would surprise me outside of maybe beating Boston, just because of how just insane Boston's looked. And Milwaukee hasn't played, I mean, they keep playing these close games when they play Boston, but it feels like they always fall short at the end. So I'm not sure they can beat the Celtics as currently constructed, but they may not have to play them until the conference finals. And for all we know, maybe they won't have to play them at all. I mean, we've seen crazier things than to think Boston could lose to Cleveland or New York or somebody in the second round if there's injury luck, ball bounces a certain way, whatever it may be. So to me, Milwaukee is a force to be reckoned with in the East. I still probably don't think they're making the finals now, just because it's really hard to bet against Boston. But if you're putting Boston aside, to me, they have as good a shot as anybody in the East, and they are legitimate contenders, because there is a scenario where they make the finals. And I think that they have the top tier elite talent. I think their role players are coming around. I think Doc Rivers is starting to figure out how to maximize this group. And I do think they still will make some sort of deal around the margins. And then Chris Middleton hopefully can get back to at least 80% of what he used to be. And look, this was obviously not a good game for the Thunder, but it's not indicative of how their season has gone at all. They're 20-5 still. They're the number one seed in the Western Conference and have been that for largely the entire season. They were the favorites to do so. They have lived up to every bit of hype you could have possibly had for them, despite the fact that Chet Holmgren went down just 10 games into the season. They still boast a very impressive record. They've been very good even without him, even when they had to go super small with no Chet before Hartenstein got back. They were still winning games despite having no size whatsoever. Now Hartenstein's back. He's fitting like a glove on this team, bringing just high level facilitation as a connector offensively for them. He's been elite as a rebounder, 12 per game already this season, 12 and a half points per game. He's got great touch in the paint with the little floater. In the short roll, he makes good decisions. I mean, he's been just perfect. Everything they could have hoped for when they signed him, everything that everyone said that he was going to be great for this team, he's been that. And Chet was playing great before he got hurt too. So they've got two good options at center, and they've had to play different styles with just Hartenstein, with just Chet, with neither of them. Eventually, hopefully, they'll have both of them. But I just say that to say that even despite the lack of certainty at the center position, they've been awesome. They are a truly, truly dominant defensive team on the season. They have 103 defensive rating. That's number one in the NBA by a full 2 points over the next team in Houston. And on top of that, I mean, if you just look at the last few years, like 103 defensive rating is not something that happens in the modern NBA very often. They've been truly, truly dominant across the board. And so, of course, look, I'm not going to be like, oh, Thunder aren't good or not contenders because they lost the cup. The cup is the cup. It is what it is. It's one game. You're not going to really write anything home about it. But what I will say, I do think that this game kind of magnified the issues with this team and kind of the things I've been saying about them for a while. They were my pick to make the finals preseason. They were my team to win the championship preseason. I still think probably Boston is the only team that I could confidently say has a pretty good chance to beat them at this point. I think that they're pretty comfortable favorites in the West, especially when you consider Chet will come back, and when they're full strength, they're going to be a handful for any team. But they haven't looked spectacular offensively, and that was my concern for them. I mean, they're ninth in offensive rating, so it's not like they've been bad. But after Shea, they still have question marks for me. And this game was kind of exactly that in a nutshell, basically. Because, look, Shea just, he didn't have it. He didn't have it in this game. And Jalen Williams didn't step up like you would hope he would. They didn't have Chet to be able to hopefully step up like they hoped maybe he would in those scenarios. And so my one concern with OKC, I'm not concerned about really anything else for this team. I mean, they're a menace defensively across the board. Everybody plays defense. Everybody excels on that end. They've got shooters. They've got connective offensive players that keep the ball moving, with guys like Hartenstein, Caruso, Kayson Wallace, just down the line. But the point is, the one thing that they lack is a reliable second scorer. And I said this in the preseason, that they need to get a reliable second scorer. And I said, maybe it can be Jalen Williams. He could just ascend and become that. Or they might need to look externally. And J-Dub's been good this year. I mean, 21.7 points per game, 50% from the field, just under 39% from three. Pretty similar numbers to what he had last year, 6 rebounds, 5 assists. But it does still kind of feel like he lacks a little bit of consistency and a little bit of ability to say, oh, Shea, you don't have it tonight? Then no problem, man. I got us. Because that's what the great number twos do. That's what Jaylen Brown did for Tatum in the playoffs last year. That's what Devin Booker and Kevin Durant do for each other on a nightly basis. Like the teams that have really, really good, solid number twos are the teams that are going to be in a place to be successful in the postseason. And we saw it last year in the second round against Dallas, when Jaylen Williams just, he didn't play very well. He didn't play very well, and it was maybe the biggest reason that OKC didn't win the series, because they played well enough defensively to beat Dallas. Shea played well enough individually and offensively to be able to win the series as well. But J-Dub, 17 points a game in that series, only 42% from the field, and he had these stretches where he just kind of like feels like he's not out there. He just goes silent, and you forget that he's even on the court and just not super involved and not being aggressive enough. And this game kind of felt like flashbacks to that. So I am nitpicking the Thunder right now. I know that they are the favorite in the West resoundingly, and they should be. They're still my pick to make the finals in the West, as they have been all year. But the point is, I'd feel a lot better if they added somebody or if Jalen Williams could be a little bit more consistent as a number two option. He's a very good player and he's very good defensively. He can put up 20 a night, but I just feel like that is the one thing that they might be lacking. And so look, maybe I doubt they're going to shake this thing up too much by trying to get a more reliable number two option that I feel like if they're going to add, it's going to be more on the margins like they did with Caruso and Hartenstein. But I'm just saying that for the long term, for this to be really sustainable as a team that wins multiple championships with this core, I think Jalen Williams is going to need to take another little bit of a leap to become a more reliable guy that when it's nut crunch time, he's ready to go. And if Shea doesn't have it, he can pick up the slack. Because right now, I don't really feel like he's doing that consistently, despite how solid he's been. But it feels like in the biggest games, he tends to not show up as much. And so I just think that they're going to need more reliable secondary scoring outside of Shea because their offense can get kind of ugly sometimes. They jack up a lot of threes. They've got a lot of guys that are more spot up shooters, not really creators. Even Chet's not like really that much of a creator. Hartenstein is a good passer, but he's not a creator. Alex Caruso can make some things happen, but he's not a creator for others really. Like they just don't have the super reliable second guy that can create offensive shots for other people or go get themselves a bucket outside of Jalen Williams. And so he needs to be reliable and he needs to be better if they want to have sustained success come postseason time. But I think he's capable of it. I've been saying this, that I'm calling him out to an extent, but I think it's in him. I think he can do it. I think he can be a number two. He's still really young. I mean, he's 23 years old. So it is a lot to ask. It's a lot to expect, but they are going to continue to have expectations if they keep playing this well. So they're 20-5. They have an elite defense, one of the best, if not the best that we've seen in the last decade. And they've got the star player, 30 point per game score. They've got a damn good coach. They're deep. They've got all the assets in the world to add. So there's a lot to like about this team, and they're not skipping a beat without Chet. They're going to need him come postseason time. I'll say that, but you get what I'm saying. And so I'm just saying the one thing that I think if we had to find something on this team to kind of take away from this cup and just from the postseason last year, it's the second reliable scorer. Is J-Dub going to show up in the biggest moments when it matters? And if he doesn't, who's going to? Because if not, I don't see a path for them to really make a legitimate run at the championship and beating a team like Boston without that sort of consistency from other guys besides Shea. I just briefly now want to talk about the two teams that lost in the semifinals, the Hawks and Rockets, two kind of younger up-and-coming teams to an extent, the very different from each other overall in the grand scheme of things, with the Rockets having very limited experience across the board and the Hawks being a little bit more of a retooled team rather than a team that was rebuilding before this like the Rockets were. But on the Hawks side of things, they started off kind of inconsistent. They were 2-4 to start the year. They were 4-7, 7-11, but they've played very well recently. I mean, they've won 7 of their last 9 games, and they've played the good teams really well. They've lost to the Wizards twice, which is just they were really injured back when they lost those games. But regardless, the good teams, they played really well. They beat the Cavs twice back to back. They've beaten Boston in Boston. They've beaten the Bucks, the Lakers, the Knicks. Like, they've knocked off some good teams and a lot of these games on the road in Milwaukee, in Cleveland, in New York. So they've shown that they can compete with the top talent and the other top teams in the NBA. And it's no secret, I've been high on the Hawks. They were one of my kind of sleeper teams this year that could be a little better than you think. I picked them to make the playoffs, despite most consensus having them as a sub 500 team that likely peaks out in the play-in. But I really like what they've done. And it all starts with Trae Young, obviously, but they've gotten a lot of contributions from other players as well. Dyson Daniels has been as advertised. I said preseason, addition by subtraction for DeJounte Murray, and then adding in Dyson Daniels. And I mean, he's been the perfect complement next to Trae. He leads the NBA in steals by a large margin. He's averaging 3 per game. He's just a ridiculous defender. No question about it, on his way to being on the first team all defensive team this season, even as a guard, but he's got length. I mean, he's super long. He's 6'8". He's huge for a guard, but he can do stuff offensively too. He hasn't shot the ball particularly well from deep, but that hasn't really mattered. He's a very good passer, playmaker for his size and position. He's still giving them some good scoring punch with 13 points per game. But what he's doing defensively, setting the tone for this team, is just everything they've desperately needed in the Trae Young era. I mean, they have been a mess defensively for the large portions of Trae's career to this point. And this season, the Hawks are 18th in defensive rating. Not spectacular, but it's an improvement from where they've been. And you can see it eye test wise, despite what the advanced stats say. Like, Dyson Daniels had Jalen Brunson in hell in that NBA Cup game. I mean, he couldn't get anything going. And that's just such a weapon to be able to throw out on guys like him, throw him on a Dame Lillard, throw him on a Tyrese Maxey, throw him on any number of guards that they're going to be facing throughout the not only regular season, but come playoff time. And he's just a special, special defender. And I also really like what he does offensively. So that has been just such a huge part of their success this season. DeAndre Hunter is having the best year of his career, strangely, in the first year that he hasn't been starting. He's at 19 points per game, 45% from three. Not sure how sustainable that is. He's like 27 years old. So it's pretty rare to see dudes just take random leaps like that, especially when he's in a reduced role too. So it's strange, but he's been a huge difference maker for them. I mean, he went off against the Knicks in the Cup game as well. Bogdanovich has been in and out of the lineup health wise, but we know what he brings as a sixth man. Reese Hoshea has been not a very good shooter, or not consistent offensively at all, really, but I like what he does defensively. He at least like is a high IQ player, makes the right cuts, makes the right reads offensively. If his shot can start falling, it's going to be a huge difference for them. But I think they like a lot of what he brings just from an energy and effort perspective. Clint Capella, Okongwu, both having very solid years. We know what those guys bring. But then Jalen Johnson has been an all-star level player this season. 20 points a game, 10 rebounds, 5.5 assists, shooting just under 50%. Three-point shooting at 34%, a little bit below average, but still respectable on good volume. And this is a dude that's like, he's 23 years old, and he legitimately is playing at all-star level. Like, I think if I was picking all-star selections today, I would have him in the all-star game as the Hawks representative over Trae, even though Trae has been very good in his own respect. I think Jalen Johnson is what makes his team go. He is a beast in transition, just a huge threat getting to the basket. He's a really good passer and playmaker for his size and position at 6'9", 6'10", at the power forward spot. He is just another reliable scorer next to Trae that they really haven't had in recent years. I mean, when they made the conference finals back in 2021, John Collins was the second option for that team. And so Jalen Johnson is better than John Collins, but he has been just a little bit more of that reliable second option that Trae has desperately needed. It's not like, I still think of Jalen Johnson as less of a scorer and more of like a do-it-all hybrid player. You know, I don't think he's a shoot first guy necessarily. He obviously can score well, averaging 20 a game, but I actually think he's more of like an offensive hub type guy, like a Sabonis type player. Not that he is like Sabonis. I just mean that his mentality in terms of like, he's just trying to run the offense a little bit, get other guys involved, pick his spots offensively rather than just be a pure scorer. I'm going to look for my shot type of guy. And I think he does a lot of his damage in transition as well as a scorer and getting downhill, but he's been awesome. And then, I mean, it all comes back to the star player. The biggest reason they've been better in my opinion is because Trae's adjusted his game. I mean, he's shooting a lot less this season compared to where he's been over the last couple years, taking only under 17 shots a game, the lowest since his rookie season. And he's leading the NBA in assists at 12.1 per game. He's averaging only 21.5 points. His shooting has been awful. Honestly, he's shooting 39% from the field on the year, under 32% from three. So it's a little strange to see the percentages go down considering the volume is down. Normally that's correlated the other way around, where if you shoot less, you're more efficient. But regardless, I mean, I don't think he's going to finish the year shooting 39%. I'm sure he's going to start making some more shots soon. But he is dedicated to just being the point guard on this team, getting other guys involved and not taking like bad, chucking up bad logo threes just because he feels like it sometimes. And playing more in the flow of things, he's the engine that has the Hawks going at every time, at any time offensively. And just kudos to him because we've for years been like, if he could just adjust his game a little bit, either play more off ball, be willing to be more of a spot up shooter more than a guy who's just pounding, dribbling the ball to death. And he's not exactly doing it that way, but he's doing it in the other way where he's like, I'm just going to be the best playmaker in the league. And it's hard to argue against that he's been that this season. So I like the Hawks. Obviously, they're not really close to legitimately contending, but I think they've got a real shot to be a 6-7 seed, you know, maybe sneak up into the 5 seed area if Orlando falls back a little bit without Paolo and Franz. But they are at least showing what they're capable of by knocking off these top teams, playing really well over the last few weeks. And now that they're healthy, it'd be interesting to see what they could do if they could get like another piece to this. I like Brandon Ingram as a guy that could maybe help them out a little bit. We'll see if they end up pursuing that kind of trade. They might want to just kind of ride this out, see what this team looks like. But of course, they have incentive to be good because they don't have their control over their pick over the next few years. So they can't tank. I think they're going to be too good to really have to worry about that. But yeah, I like what I've seen out of the Hawks so far this season. And then on the Rockets side of things, I've talked about them on my last episode. They're 17-9, third in the Western Conference right now, second in defensive rating, at a 105.6 defensive rating, which, you know, is spectacular, but it gets overshadowed by how good OKC's been. But they're damn good defensively. Ime Udoka is an awesome, awesome coach, especially defensively. I mean, remember back when he was in Boston, he had that team with the number one defense by a mile. He's doing similar things for Houston right now with worse personnel. I mean, to think that a Alperen Şengün anchored team could be this good defensively just shows how insanely good Udoka is as a coach, getting these guys to buy into playing both ends of the court. And then, of course, I mean, I've talked about Amen Thompson, Tari Eason, what these guys are doing for them off the bench. And then Şengün is having a little down of a year numbers wise, but I think that's because he's buying into the collective. You know, he's not trying to do too much. He's doing exactly what the team needs, which is be a force down low, distribute a little bit offensively. But they're a by committee team. They're spread the wealth. They don't have anybody averaging 20 points per game, but they have seven guys averaging 11 or more points per game. And that's kind of what their whole plan is this season. But I do have concerns about them. And I talked about it last time. I'm still not totally bought in on them as like a team that's going to be a top three seed, even though they've been there all year. I'm not bought in on them as a team that's going to make any noise in the postseason. And it comes down to the offense. It looks really ugly sometimes. They're 19th in offensive rating, which is just really low for a team that is going to have aspirations in the postseason. And all of their leading shot takers are inefficient outside of Şengün, who's still 47% for a close 7-footer. Like, you'd maybe hope he's a little bit more efficient too. But Jabari Smith, 43% from the field. Dylan Brooks, 42% from the field. Jalen Green, under 40% from the field. Van Vliet, 38% from the field. Like, they shoot 43.7% from the field as a team. They're not a good offensive team. None of their top scorers are reliable in any capacity. They don't have good shooters either. Van Vliet's only 30% from three in the year. Jalen Green, 31%. Şengün, 26%. Jabari Smith, 37%. Amen Thompson, 29%. Tari Eason, 32%. Even Reed Shepard in his spot minutes, 31%. Like, they don't have good shooters. They don't have reliable offensive creators. They've got guys that can create. Van Vliet can create. Jalen Green can create. But when they create, do they generate good shots? That's the question. Because in Jalen Green's case specifically, often that's not the case. So, with that said, I think they might need to make a move if they want to have any success in the postseason this year. But again, I don't think they need to. I think they could stand pat and it would be totally fine. And look, they're going to make the playoffs. They'll probably lose first round. Nobody's going to be disappointed. Nobody's going to say it was a failed season. They've got a bright future regardless. So just ride the high, see where this defense can take them, see what happens in the postseason. If they lose as a higher seed to a more experienced team, it happens. That's step one to contention. Any team that wants to get over that hump, a young team coming off a rebuild, get building back into contention, that's a necessary step. Look at OKC losing to Dallas as the one seed last season in the second round, despite winning close to 60 games last year. Like, it's just, it's part of the growing pains of a young team. And so they'll take their lumps. Maybe in a couple years, either some of their guys can ascend into more reliable offensive players, or they can add somebody, whether it be via free agency or trade. They've got avenues to add both ways, with Van Vliet's contract expiring soon, who's making 40 plus million. And then they've got a number of picks between the Brooklyn picks, Phoenix picks, their own picks. They've got picks to move if they want to. But yeah, I'd like to see more reliable offensive play out of them. I'd like them to not have Jalen Green as their number one option for me to believe in them. But not taking anything away from what they've done, their defense is special. They'll continue to be good. They'll continue to be in the playoffs. They'll make the playoffs most likely. But I just don't really trust it out of them until we've either seen them take their playoff lumps or until we get some more consistent offensive play out of them. But in terms of the cup overall, I think it's been a mild success. I won't say it's been crazy successful, because I do think there's a lot of teams who haven't taken it super seriously. And I do think that there are fans of teams who are glad that their team was not in it, because they get extra rest. They're not playing a game that actually doesn't count towards their record or anything. There's just, it's strictly a money incentive for the players. There's really no other benefit than, I mean, do you want to say we're on the big stage or whatever? Like, there's not enough of an incentive for teams to really, really care about it. But I do think, like, the games have been a little more competitive, elevated, just effort in some of the, even just pool play. And I think the players, like, it's not like they don't care. But I do think it's just silly to me that there's no team incentive, really, because it feels like a miss. Like, why do you want to be in the finals if, as a team, if it doesn't even count for your, it doesn't even count for the record? Like, to me, that's a miss. And I think there's a few things they could tweak to make it a little bit better. I think that the last game needs to count for the record, for sure. But it should be, I don't know if you should necessarily penalize teams for, like, making it that far. Like, OKC gets an extra loss necessarily, but make it the win count for two or something like that. Maybe each win in the knockout stage is two wins, or you just do an automatic tiebreaker. So no matter who you're tied with head to head, whatever, all the other things in the standings at end of season, you just get the tiebreaker because you won the cup. That's the tiebreaker, basically. But I still think the multiple wins is probably an even better thing, because it's just giving more incentive. Tiebreaker is kind of like, how often does that even really come into play? But you could essentially shoot up the standings a spot or two if you get a couple extra wins on under your belt as a team. So I think having it more tied to the standings and wins is going to make players and teams try more, because that's directly affecting their where they are in the standings and where they might end up being come postseason time. So I think that is probably the easiest thing to do. Maybe just make all the knockout games count as two wins, because then an opportunity to get two wins is huge. That's a huge advantage. And then if you win the whole thing, that's three extra wins you could have from winning in the quarter, semis, and then the final. So that's a huge incentive for me. I know it won't be like same number of games played necessarily for everyone, but everyone had a chance to try to make it and win it. So I still think it's fair. I don't think it's unfair to do that. I also think from a format perspective, they could tweak a few things. I think pool play is a little weird when it's like the back-to-back against the same team and one of them counts for the cup and one of them doesn't. Like, that's just kind of strange to me. That's happened a lot to try to cut down travel with some of these matchups. But I think what they should do is just pick a 2-week period those 2 weeks are when all the pool play games happen. Everything in that 2 weeks is pool play. They could spread the games out, make it 2 to 3 games per night. You don't have to have these action packed schedules where everybody's playing at the same time. This way you could actually have people watching more of the games because they're not all happening at the same time. You can nationally televise them more, advertise it as sort of a 2 week event in the NBA for pool play. And then that way there's no confusion of which games are cup games, which games are not cup games, the Tuesday and Friday thing they have now. And hey, if you want to avoid Sundays to compete with football, then avoid Sundays. Just don't put games on those days during the 2 weeks. But there wouldn't be any travel or like unfairness with back-to-backs and scheduling, because that's also been a thing for some of these games, because you could just say every team's got 4 games over 2 weeks, so 2 games in the weeks, they should be sufficiently spread out. And I think that would just be better for understanding how it works with when the games are, for watchability. Maybe the last day everybody has a game on the same day just to prevent scoreboard watching with point differential and whatnot. But I think that would make it better, because right now the random Tuesday and Friday feels just kind of, I don't know, it's hard to follow. Also think that, you know, I think down the line, this will be easier once the inevitable expansion happens and there's 32 teams, but it'd be kind of cool just to do one big giant bracket of everybody in the league, single elimination, which it's hard to do with 30 teams because you'd have to have buys and then it gets kind of complicated. But if you had 32 teams, which it looks like we're headed that way, then you can get a perfect split in the bracket and you could just do a full on rank the teams 1 through 32, or you could keep it with the conferences 1 through 16 on each side. But of course, then, one, you'd have to wait till that actually happens. But two, then it begs the question, like, do you even have pool play? Do you just rank at a certain point, rank the teams based on what the standings are? Because it's like, what's really the point of the pool play if it's not to get into a tournament? If you're just doing 1 through 32, you might as well just do the standings. But hey, maybe that is... would be a better product where it's literally just a preview of what the playoffs could look like, you know? And that would be kind of cool, because you look at the standings at any given point and you start saying, like, if they held right now, these would be the matchups and I would pick this team over this team. So it could be kind of cool just to see like a small snapshot preview of what the playoffs might look like. But obviously, like I said, that's going to require that there be 32 teams, rather than 30, just for that to be not a weird situation where there's buys and that complicates things as well. But overall, like I said, I think it was like a mild success as I described it, where it's not a failure, it's not lame, it's not like nobody cares, but I still think they're working out the kinks and we'll see what the final product of this ends up looking like as time goes on. But it's pretty cool to see LeBron win MVP the first year, Giannis win MVP the second year. At least it's not like somebody super random. Like we'll look back and be like, okay, it's two of the greatest players of this generation have won it thus far, which is probably also setting a good precedent for other stars to want to care a little bit about it, because they can say they have a cup championship and those other guys can't. So next I want to talk about some trade stuff, because there's been a lot of rumors and things going around about names that might be out there, some big named players potentially. And December 15th marked when all of the players who signed as free agents in the offseason could officially be traded, which is about a third of the league. So that is kind of when initial trade discussions at least start, because there's a lot more flexibility for teams to trade guys. We don't always see December trades. We did see one last year when OG Anunoby got sent to the Raptors, but that was more of an outlier. We don't really see teams go too crazy with stuff until closer to the trade deadline, which is in February typically. But we did have a trade recently. Dennis Schroeder got sent to the Warriors for D'Anthony Melton, who is out for the season. So essentially just an expiring contract. And I believe Golden State sent back 3 second round picks, and Brooklyn sent a second round pick to Golden State. So essentially in net, it was an injured player and 2 seconds going back for Dennis Schroeder, which, you know, if you're the Warriors, I get it. It's a low risk trade. 2 second round picks, I mean, they're not going to lose sleep over that. Melton was out for the year anyway, and this is a team that in theory is win now. They got to make it happen this year or next year with Steph Curry's clock certainly ticking based on his age, 36 years old at this point. But Schroeder's had an awesome year too. I mean, 18 a game, just under 7 assists, 45% from the field, 39% from three. Brooklyn's almost been too good. a lot of people thought they were going to be a bottom feeder with Washington, a team that would tank hard for Cooper Flagg, but they've been very competitive. I mean, they've been a little under 500, but they've got some good wins on the season. They've beaten Golden State. They've beaten Phoenix. They've been competitive in most of their games. And Schroeder's been a big part of that because he has just been spectacular for them, particularly offensively. And he's always has good intensity defensively as well. But the Schroeder trade doesn't do much for me if I'm thinking about what it like moving a needle for Golden State. I don't really think he's what they needed. To me, what Golden State needs is a second reliable scorer next to Steph. And I don't mean a guy like Schroeder who on a bad team can put up 18 a game. I mean a guy who is a score first guy that can get you 20 to 25 on a given night and compliment Steph on a nightly basis. I think Schroeder is a good role player. He's a complimentary piece. He's not going to hurt them necessarily. But I don't see him being a guy that's going to like be the reliable second scorer that they need. We've seen him be on good contending teams in the past, and lots of times that's when he's been at his worst, which is kind of weird. I mean, he's just one of those kind of good stats, bad team guys where in certain situations you're like, damn, this dude is actually legitimately really solid. But then in other situations, it's a disaster. I mean, his time in Boston, he was terrible for them. He still averaged 14 a game, but it was like they were so much better once they got rid of him. Similar with the Lakers. I mean, there were a lot of people who loved the addition when they got him, but then when they let him walk, nobody was losing sleep over it, you know? And with Brooklyn, he had been great. He had been their lead guy offensively, but he's not going to be that in Golden State. He's probably going to have to play next to Steph in crunch time. So they're going to have a small backcourt. But again, I don't really trust his shot. I know he's 39% this year. He's 34% for his career. He hasn't been a good spot up shooter in his life in the NBA. And he's just really inconsistent year to year, month to month, you know? So he's 31 years old at this point. He's a good player. Like I said, in a vacuum, it's not some trade that I'm like, wow, why did Golden State do that? I get why they did it. I mean, he's going to give them something Melton can't, which is actually play on the court. And he does a lot of nice things offensively, especially when he's making a shot from outside. I just don't see it as a move that like significantly changes my opinion on Golden State. I think that they were probably heading for a back end of the playoffs finish this season, 6, 7, 8 seed. And I think I still feel the same way about them right now, even with Schroeder. But there are bigger fish to fry in the trade market right now. Jimmy Butler has largely been rumored to be available. Pat Riley and the Heat do not appear to want to extend him. He is getting up there in age, 35, 36 years old. He's an expiring contract, has a player option that he's pretty publicly been saying that he's probably going to decline, or at least those have been the reports, and that he will opt out of that and try to get a deal worth another $100 million plus or so. And it doesn't look like Miami wants to give him that. And so if they know that's what he wants and there's teams that maybe can give him that, it might be in their best interest to move him because he's been inconsistent during the regular season over the past few years. Anyway, he's super injury prone. In the grand scheme of things, he's been relatively durable this season. But I mean, he hasn't played 65 games one single time since getting to Miami. And last postseason, he was injured once again. And so I understand why Miami might want to move off of him because, like I said, he's just they need to recoup the value, at least whatever value they can get out of him, because they're not contending anyway. Tyler Harris had a great season for them, but Bam has been disappointing and they just don't have the juice offensively, in my opinion, that they need. And it's not like they've been some defensive juggernaut either. They are in the playoff picture right now, but I've been lower on the Heat than most. And I even predicted preseason. One of my unpopular opinions was that not only would the Heat miss the playoffs, but Jimmy Butler, it would be his final season in Miami. And it looks like that still might be the case. So let's talk through some of his potential destinations. The teams that have been linked to him at this point are the Warriors, as I mentioned, the Phoenix Suns, the Dallas Mavericks, and the Houston Rockets. So I'll mainly focus on those teams, starting with Golden State. Yeah, I mean, I think he'd be a good get for them. That is the kind of player that I do think would change my opinion of Golden State. I worry a little bit about their spacing in that type of scenario, because if you're playing him plus Draymond Green, then those are two guys that are not great three-point shooters, not guys that you really need to respect a ton outside. But of course, I mean, Butler is one of those guys where, look, is he a great three-point shooter? No, but you have to guard him because he's such a threat with the ball. If you're going to leave him wide open out on the perimeter and he gets the ball, he's got a clear path getting downhill to the basket, which is not what you want either. So I don't worry about that too much. It sounds like Kuminga is probably going to have to be in whatever deal they make for a larger salary, and then probably Wiggins as well. I don't know if you've got to throw Pajemski in there, who obviously I'm high on, but he has had an awful season this year, just about as bad as you it could be at this point. 38% from the field, 25% from three, just not shooting the ball well offensively. But yeah, I mean, I think Butler, a core of Butler, Green, Buddy Hield, I don't think it makes them a finals contender necessarily, but it makes them a threat to make a run. You know, I think they could knock off a Denver, a Phoenix, a Dallas potentially if things go their way with a Jimmy Butler on the team. Because like I said, they need shot creation next to Steph. They need guys who can score 20 to 25 points per game next to Steph. And right now they don't have any consistency in that role between Wiggins, who shot the ball well, but I mean, we know how bad he can be at his worst. Kuminga, not a reliable scorer or shooter to this point. Pajemski having a bad year, as I mentioned. Buddy Hield has cooled off significantly since his hot start. And so it's really just Steph and a bunch of role players. And so Jimmy Butler certainly fills the void of the number two option for them. But I still wonder if it's enough to like beat OKC. And I'm not sure it is, unfortunately for them. On the Dallas side of things, I don't really see how this deal happens. This is the one where I'm just like, salary wise, like they probably would have to trade too many significant players in their rotation to make this happen. Like, are they really going to trade Clay after they just signed him? Kind of find that hard to believe. You're not trading Kyrie, obviously not Luka, but then at that point, then you're probably having to trade like Gafford or PJ Washington or somebody like that. But those guys are pretty integral to what this team does. You know, I don't know if I'd want to trade Gafford for Butler, only because then you're really relying on Derek Lively. And then if he gets hurt, suddenly you're back to having a terrible center rotation, which that was their strength. That's what made them so good in the postseason last year, was the 48 minutes of solid center play between Gafford and Lively. So I wouldn't want to move Gafford. And then I don't see them moving Clay. I would just be kind of surprised if they ship Clay out to the Heat just based on his stature and how that was sort of the big offseason acquisition for them. I think they've liked what they've gotten out of him so far. His numbers are down scoring wise, 30, but he's still 39% from three, but streaking inconsistent. But that's kind of what Clay has been since he came back from his injuries, and even to an extent before the injuries. And then PJ Washington, again, like, I guess they could ship him out, but again, you've got to get there with the salary somehow. So I just don't see the fit with Dallas, because I just don't think Dallas is going to want to move any of those guys, and they would have to be able to take back such a big salary. So I'm not really considering Dallas a big threat here. Then with Houston, I mean, their front office has outwardly come out and said that they don't want to make any big shakeups this season and that they want to ride out their core. So I mean, I'm inclined to believe them and take that at face value. They certainly could make it happen. Between, you could send either Dylan Brooks' contract or Van Vliet's contract with some combination of, if they want to go ahead and just move off Jalen Green, which I personally think would be a good move, or they can ship out different contracts between Tari Eason, Jock Landale, Steven Adams. Like, there's expirings that they could send out and to match. So they wouldn't have to give up a ton. I mean, if you're giving up like Brooks, Adams, Eason, and a pick, like, probably fair value. But again, I'm not sure that they want to rush into this thing, because Şengün's 22. Jabari Smith is 21. Thompson's 22. Eason's 23. Reed Shepard is 20. Jalen Green's 22. Like, I think they want to stay on their relative timeline that they're on right now. I think they want to take their playoff loss this season and build on that, and then add players either more through the draft, continue to develop guys like Reed Sheppard and Amin Thompson, or add guys more down the road once they kind of know what they need. I mean, obviously, I think offensively, that's where their focus should be for what they're looking to add to this team. But I, like OKC last year, everybody knew they kind of needed to have a more reliable shooter than Giddey and add some size. But they wanted to see it play out, make sure that that's really what they needed. And then they went and added Caruso and Hartenstein to fill those roles. And so I think Houston wants to do something similar. So they seem like the most logical basketball fit to me, because if you've got a team of VanVleet, Şengün, Butler, like Thompson or Eason off the bench, Jabari Smith, like that makes sense to me. And I think Butler fits in perfectly with how they play. Defensively, he's great. He would bring a number one option and some actual shot creation and reliable scoring on offense. And he also is just like a match made in heaven for a Ime Udoka team from a toughness perspective. But I'm not sure I see it being realistic based on what we've heard. And then lastly, the wild card team here, which it doesn't make a ton of sense when you first hear the name, is the Phoenix Suns, because they don't have a lot of flexible options to make deals like this. They're not trading Devin Booker. They're not trading Kevin Durant. And so that leaves one option. They have to trade Bradley Beal if they do this deal. But it's very complicated, because not only does Phoenix need to decide that that's what they want to do, they have to either convince Miami that they want Bradley Beal's contract, despite how injury prone he's been and inconsistent this season from game to game, and the fact that he is owed a lot of money over the next two seasons after this year, excess of $100 million, which they don't want to pay Jimmy Butler that, so why would they want that from Beal? Or they could ship him to a third team, which I'm sure you could probably find a team to take his contract in general, but then you probably have to attach assets to it. And Phoenix doesn't really have assets. And if they're sending their one first round pick that they can trade to that third team, then what is Miami getting back in return? So that's the question. And then none of that even mentions the fact that Beal has a no trade clause, and Miami was his preferred destination when he was getting traded last summer. So I don't necessarily know if that would be an issue for Beal, but it might, because I think a lot of the appeal of him going to Miami was to play with Jimmy Butler and be relevant as a playoff team to complement what they already had. So if you're getting traded for Jimmy Butler, he may be less excited about that potentially, but who knows? It's just very nuanced, because then what if he goes to a third team? Is he going to want to go to Chicago, to Detroit, to whatever team is that third team, Brooklyn? Like, it's going to be a lot of coordination. You're going to have to make sure Beal's on board to go wherever he wants to go. You don't even know if Miami really wants him. Maybe if you attach that pick, Miami's cool with it. But they weren't really interested last time when he was available because of that no trade clause. So I'm not really sure what would have changed. But I will say this, the NBA, if it's taught me anything, it's that if players want to get somewhere, they very often do. So if Jimmy Butler decides, I'm going to go to Phoenix, and that's what I'm standing by, I'll only re-sign with Phoenix, I want to go to Phoenix, I'm sure it could happen. I'm sure it could. Just because a lot of people said Kevin Durant to Phoenix couldn't or wouldn't happen, and then that happened. A lot of people thought Bradley Beal to Phoenix was not realistic, and then that happened. And so I'm not going to sit here and say like there's no chance, because I think, look, if maybe Phoenix says, hey, take Beal, we'll give you our 2031 unprotected first round pick, and maybe that's enough to entice Miami, because that pick is very valuable on the open market, I'm sure. And if that's the case, then it could be that easy. Or maybe they decide to tell Beal like, hey, it's been an awkward fit in Phoenix. There's no denying that. So we know that in Washington, you wanted to not be on a total losing franchise. And in Phoenix, we've in theory contended, at least tried to, but it's been a clunky fit as the third option. So let's find a happy medium. You can go to a team that isn't awful. They're at least decent, but then you can be a number two or a number one option there, you know? So maybe that is what they could compromise somewhere there. So I can't rule it out, but I would say this would be a spectacular swing for Phoenix if they could make it work, because God, Butler would help them in so many ways, but not in the ways people really think. Obviously, he's an upgrade over Beal, as a player, but then also it's such a better positional fit because when Kevin Durant doesn't play, which he has missed a good chunk of the season thus far, they are tiny. They are a tiny, tiny, tiny team. They're playing a 6'4 guy at power forward when he doesn't play in Royce O'Neal. And so they've got no size in the perimeter without Durant. And that's why they've been so inconsistent. And that's why they're 1-9 when Kevin Durant doesn't play, because they've been atrocious defensively without him. And so they need size in the perimeter. And Jimmy Butler is 6'7", 6'8". That's a huge upgrade over Beal, who's 6'4". Not to mention that it's not like Beal exactly is super engaged on defense all the time. Jimmy Butler is, he excels on that end of the court. And so I think it's a great fit across the board because Butler also doesn't really need touches offensively. And they've got two guys that average 25 plus points per game. So Butler can relax on offense, averages 15 points a game, have an occasional 25-point game, but not have to really be relied on offensively. So I think it'd be a great fit for them. I think it raises their ceiling significantly. I still think they would need to address their center position because Nurkic has been a total mess. They need to either add a better defensive-minded player there or at least a better rim-running finisher, lob threat player at that position. But regardless, if Butler goes there, then things get very interesting. I think if they then make a move for at least decent center upgrade, then they could be right in the conversation with anybody in the West after OKC. Still think OKC is going to be the favorite regardless of any moves that get made, but at least there's a conversation that starts to get had there about Phoenix being the next team there. I think that they could compete with Dallas at that point. I think that they're probably ahead of teams like Denver, ahead of teams like Golden State easily. I think that they would beat Houston in that scenario. So, it really just depends. And then not to mention that, I mean, getting off the Beal contract certainly would help Phoenix. I mean, let's not pretend that that contract isn't one of the worst in the NBA. And from their perspective, even if Butler walks in free agency after the year, guess what? They then can become no longer an apron team, which gives them so much more flexibility. So even if they just have that $50 million coming off the books, then it's a huge upgrade for them just in terms of flexibility moving forward. They can re-sign Tyus Jones, which they're not going to be able to do if they're above the apron. They can look to add players elsewhere and maybe improve some of the complementary pieces around the top two guys. They can add a center upgrade, you know, actually aggregate salaries, which they haven't been able to do at all with the apron restrictions. So it's a win-win if they make this deal. But again, I think it really only can happen with Phoenix if Jimmy Butler says it's Phoenix or bust for me, which maybe he will, maybe he won't. But other than that, it's probably not very likely that he ends up there. But you cannot rule it out because of today's NBA. If a player wants to play for a team, they normally end up playing for that team. And that's going to do it for this episode of the Sean Jones NBA Show. Thank you so much for listening. I will probably pick back up post-holidays. At that point, the trade deadline, All-Star weekend, those things will be right around the corner. So I'm sure there will be a lot to discuss. A lot of other rumors have gone down over the past few weeks involving guys besides Jimmy Butler. The Pelicans seem to be open to a fire sale. Zach LaVine rumors to potentially the Nuggets or even other teams seems to be floating around. So there will be a lot to discuss over the next coming week, as well as just the games, the sample size getting bigger and what teams are and aren't is becoming more clear. It's still super jumbled up in the West in terms of how compact the standings are. So I'm sure some teams will start to break away in either direction. But regardless, should be a lot to chat about over the next few weeks to months. So looking forward to it. But with that said, thank you so much for listening, and I will chat with you soon.